so close to seeing Caroline. But I forced myself to walk slowly as I made my way around the room, greeting and accepting congratulations from those I knew. Finally, I allowed myself to go toward the ballroom. The vast room gleamed white tonight. Masses of white roses and potted green cedars filled every corner and flat surface. I glanced about through the blur of a waltz, soft laughter, subdued talk, the swirl of colored silk, the slide of slippered feet across the white floor. And there she was. Color rose to her pale face when she saw me, but she stayed in place, giving her attention to another who had already claimed it. Her blonde hair, curled to either side and piled high in the back, emphasized her long white neck, made more so by the white, low-cut gown draped stylishly off her shoulders. A pale pink rose pushed deep into her swollen décolleté matched perfectly her flushed face. She fanned herself prettily and could not keep herself from glancing in my direction. I turned away just as her parents, the host and hostess for the evening, approached me. I gathered myself quickly, upset that I had been observed giving their daughter so much notice. Mr. Carden, Mrs. Carden. I greeted them with a formal bow before lifting Mrs. Carden's outreached hand. I could not escape what they both had seen, so I moved the conversation toward it. First, though, I paused for a deliberate review of Mrs. Carden's person while she feigned disinterest yet awaited my approval. I was just now admiring your beautiful daughter, but when I observe you, Mrs. Carden, I see that she but replicates your beauty. Mr. Carden grunted. Those are fine words, Burton, but I would remind you of my daughter's recent marriage.
For heaven's sakes, Mr. Carden.
Mrs. Carden took her hand from mine, and with her fan gave a light tap to her husband's arm.
Caroline has been married for 3 years. I wouldn't call that recent.
What I was saying...
Yes, yes, my dear. She has a husband, we know, but surely you have a better understanding of women than that. We always want to know that we have admirers, especially after years of marriage.
Where is he? Mr. Carden scanned the room for his son-in-law, his wife having adeptly shifted his attention.
Oh, dear,
Mrs. Carden murmured, noting the appearance of their son-in-law's parents. The oncoming people moved so quickly toward us that they unfortunately hit their mark before I could make my escape. The husband, a wealthy man I thoroughly disliked, was also a celebrated minister, well known for his dire sermons of fire and brimstone. In the past, when cornering me at a social occasion, he'd had the audacity to inform me that because of my reputation with the fairer sex, he regarded me as a candidate for his words of advice. Astounded by his nerve, I had not replied directly but wondered aloud if his thoughts of my salvation might not be better directed toward his own son, who was often publicly battling the demons of drink. Now, studying the couple, I noted how the wife, a bland pudding next to the great beef of her husband, was dwarfed. Here was an example of where a girdle, so popular with men today, might have suited a true purpose had the man thought to use one. And I wondered where gluttony sat on his list of sins. The alliance between these two families, resulting from the marriage between their children, gave catalyst to a merging of their fortunes. And as a result, these two men now stood united as a mighty force in Philadelphia's world of logging and shipping. From our first meeting, I thought Mr. Carden something of a conundrum. A polished man, he was well-versed in the ways of society and known to be generous, not just to the church, but to many other institutions. In his earlier years, Mr. Carden was involved in the fur trade, and accounts circulated of his ruthless behavior while living out among the Indians of the West. I myself heard him describe how to best kill and scalp a savage, a skill he claimed to have practiced more than once. When he spoke of the deed, from the flash of his eye and the grit of his teeth, I didn't doubt his story. Yet now he supported the museum's effort to collect Indian artifacts and often paid spectacular sums to help the members obtain what they deemed important. In fact, I suspected it was his money, and possibly his wife's influence, that had secured my upcoming ornithological excursion. However, in the case of Mr. and Mrs. Carden, I always remained aware of the treacherous waters in which I swam. for there was a dangerous duality in their views of slavery. The public knew Mr. and Mrs. Carden as abolitionists. Indeed, they presented a good image, frequently citing their approval of the fact that in this city all of the Negroes were free. But in time, I learned that Mr. Carden had a holding in one of the largest cotton plantations in Louisiana, while Mrs. Carden received a substantial yearly stipend from a wealthy father who owned a sizable farm in South Carolina, worked by his enslaved Africans. "So, Mr. Burton, I hear that you are soon to leave us," the minister addressed me. I nodded, not caring to encourage a conversation. This offended him, which suited me. He drew back his coat and put his thumbs in the pocket of his waistcoat. Thrusting his significant stomach forward, he slowly surveyed the room. "I would suppose that some husbands and fathers will breathe easier while you are away," he said to no one in particular. His wife had the decency to give a faint gasp. I was about to respond when Mrs. Carden, always the expert hostess, addressed the minister and his wife.
"Well, I'm afraid that Mr. Burton and I must leave the two of you to Mr. Carden. Mr. Burton is, after all, our man of the hour, and we must give others their chance to wish him good fortune."
She leaned into me as she skillfully led me away.
"You must ignore him," she said, "as I have learned to do."
I glanced down at her, but she was not smiling. She was what, 50 years, give or take 5 on either side? Her bad teeth were a distraction, but her fair complexion remained. And though she carried extra weight, her corsets and beautifully cut blue silk gown enhanced her full figure. Considered one of the most powerful women in Philadelphia society, she used her quick wit and charm to rule from the throne of her husband's vast wealth. As we moved away from earshot of her husband, she spoke over the music and her voice held an edge.
"Mr. Burton, you must know that it was because of my support that you were given this opportunity."
"You know how grateful I have always been for your support," I said.
"Indeed,"
she said, thrusting her chin forward as she propelled us in Caroline's direction.
"I promised my daughter to bring you to her. This is her last evening out, as tomorrow Caroline and I will leave for the country. I am concerned about her health."
Her hand was clenched vice-like on my arm, but she responded only with charm when various guests waylaid us to offer congratulations on my good fortune. As we grew closer to Caroline, Mrs. Carden leaned in to me once again.
"It is too early in the season for Mr. Carden and Mr. Preston, Caroline's husband," she added pointedly, "to be joining us at Stonehill, so they will be staying here in town. It is quiet in the country, so we shall have privacy. However, Caroline agreed to go to Stonehill only on the condition that I extend an invitation for you to visit. You will find time to do so before you leave?"
I met her penetrating gaze. "Nothing would give me greater pleasure," I said. "I shall await your invitation." I could think of little but loosening my damp collar, but I quickly forgot that as we grew closer to Caroline and I saw how thin she had grown. Then I noticed her small waistline. Wouldn't the tight stays of her corset harm our child?
Chapter 6. 1830. Pan. By the time I'm 10 years old, I'm old enough to go on my own to see my daddy on Sundays. Because I'm dressed clean and I'm learning to talk like Mr. Burton, when I ask nice, the wagons going out of town give me a ride. My daddy always waits for me at the barns behind the tavern. Then he takes me to his shelter in the woods that he keeps moving around. "Why don't you stay put?" I ask. "Then I could come find you on my own." "I got to keep moving in case that old master come looking for me," he says. "But daddy, don't you think he forgot about you by now?" "That old master is sly, and I expect I see him any day. I's ready to head out soon's I catch a sight of him." "You just go and leave me?" I ask. "Son, the best chance you got is staying with Mr. Burton. All we'd be doing is running." "What was it like being a slave?" I ask. "It's nothing I like to talk about." "But was it bad?" "It bad enough that I'd sooner die as go back living like that." "But what if they ever get you again?" I ask. "They never gonna get me again. They got to kill me before that happened," he says. After he tells me that, when I go to meet him, my head is always hurting till I see him waiting in the trees. Then I run to him, and when I give him a hug, I always got to stop myself from crying. I count on seeing him every Sunday, 'cause that's how it was all my life. The rest of the time it was just me and Mama. The best times we had was when my Mama's friend Sheila came by. Then I'd sit back and listen to the two of them talk. I liked to hear them laugh, even though Sheila had troubles of her own. Her two boys, both of them bigger than me, were always getting in a mess. And then her girl, just 14, goes out and gets her own baby. One day after Sheila leaves, I ask Mama, why that girl of hers go out and bring in another baby? Sheila says she can't feed the one she got. Those folks don't know no better because they were slaves, coming here to Philadelphia from the farm, where they don't have nobody telling them how to live free, Mama says. It's hard on them, trying to figure out how to make a living when they can't read or write. Most come from working in the fields and don't even know how to serve in a big house. Two, a lot of them still scared of the white folks. I was 6 or 7 when Mama first got sick. I did my best to help her out, but I was always happy when Sheila came over at night, sometimes bringing us food when we got none. One day she comes when I'm fussing over Mama, who was real sick that day. Sheila takes over and settles Mama, then puts me on her lap and says, "Anybody tell you that you a good boy?" Don't know why, but that gets me crying. "That's fine, child. You go ahead and cry," she says. "I know this got to be tough on you." I cry for a long time before she gives me a squeeze. "Come on now," she says. "You got to be a little man here. Your mama counting on you." "But I ain't no man," I say. "I's just a child." "That's right," she say. "But sometimes we got to grow up fast. Why, when I was your age, I was taking care of a whole house of white people." "You was?" I ask. But I don't see her face 'cause her chin was on my head. "Uh-huh," she say. "When was you a child?" "If I ever was, I forgot," she said. One Sunday, Sheila comes over when my daddy's there, and she gets to scolding him. "What you gonna do?" she asks. "This woman's not gonna make it through the winter. You can't leave the boy alone to take care of her like this." "What I gonna do here?" daddy says. "I leaves the tavern. I don't have no money to help out. She gonna be all right, and the boy's doing just fine." "You best get a job closer in," says Sheila. "And where's that? You got something lined up for me?" Sheila don't have an answer, and she goes out slamming the door behind her. Until my mama got sick, we went to church to get religion. The singing and the calling out to God lifts us up, but I always got my eye on the cake and milk they give you after. After she can't walk that far no more, at night we sit together and ask God to help us out, but I don't like it when Mama starts telling me that she gonna have to leave me and go on to see the Maker. Every time I say, "Don't go, I don't want you to go," she tells me, "Baby boy, when I get the call, I got to go. You always remember that even when you don't see me, I still right there watching out for you. Come now, you tell your mama that you never gonna forget that." I promise her over and over, but I forget all of that the night she passes. I don't care that I'm already 8 years old, and I stay put on Sheila's lap, crying. When Daddy gets there, he stands at the door like he don't know if he's in the right house. "What going on here?" he says. "She pass on," Sheila says, but there's no fighting her words. Real slow, Daddy goes over to Mama, then starts shaking her and calling out to her like he can bring her back. I bust off of Sheila's lap and run over to push him away. "Don't fuss with her. Can't you see she resting?" Daddy looks at me, then back at Mama, and he says real quiet, "I never think this gonna happen." Then he looks at me and grabs hold of my arms. "What we gonna do? What we gonna do?" he asks me, like I got the answer. Sheila takes over then, and in the morning, Daddy takes me back with him, but it don't work out. And the next Sunday, he takes me to see Mr. Burton. The thing I like best about Mr. Burton is that he don't mind when I ask questions. That's just the way I is, full of questions. Quiet just isn't for me. I'm like my mama in that, where I like the sound of talk. I like the sound of singing, too, even if it's Robert when he don't think nobody's around. Then he lets loose. One day, the slick man is working in the dining room, singing to the Lord like he's in church, when Mr. Burton and me come through to the study. Robert don't know we's there, and Mr. Burton just winks down at me, then heads on past like he don't see nothing. About a year ago, this Miss Caroline shows up at Mr. Burton's art class that he gives on Saturdays. Mr. Burton was always a quiet man, but after a few weeks of Miss Caroline taking his classes, on the day she's coming, he goes around the house whistling, something Robert says I'm not allowed to do. Robert tells me that I got to learn to be discreet, a word that he says means not to talk so much. One Saturday afternoon, I go running for him. "Something's going on in the library," I say. "Mr. Burton is in there with Miss Caroline, and it seems to me like they need some help." "Why are you bothering Mr. Burton?" Robert asks. "Molly sent me to ask him if he wants some tea, like always. I know he and Miss Caroline went to the library because I saw them go."
"Then what is the problem?"
"Well, the door is locked, and when I knock, they don't answer. Could be both of them is sick," I say. Robert tells me to stay back and goes to listen at the door. It don't take him long before he comes back and gets us both into the dining room to do some polishing. "They gonna be all right?" I ask.
"They are having a private meeting," he said. "You must never interrupt them during a private meeting."
"Never?" I ask.
"Never."
"What if there's a house fire?" I ask.
"Then you come for me," Robert says.
"And what if he was burned up?" I ask.
He gives me a sigh. "I suppose at that point you may knock on the door and shout fire."
I don't think that's what I'd say. I think that I'd say, "Mr. Burton, Mr. Burton, you best stop your private meeting because Robert is burned up and the house is on fire."
"You could talk like this all day, couldn't you?" he asks.
"You mean about a fire?" I ask.
But he don't answer me no more.
Then comes a day I walk into Malcolm's room and Mr. Burton and Miss Caroline is caught up in kissing. I'm so surprised that I just stand there until Mr. Burton sees me.
"Pen," Mr. Burton says, like I do something wrong.
I'm sorry, Mr. Burton. I come in here to clean Malcolm's cage," I say. But it's something to watch Miss Caroline's white face turning red.
"Will he tell Robert and your housekeeper?" she asks Mr. Burton, like I don't hear her.
"You know this is a private matter, Pen, that you must not speak to anyone of this," Mr. Burton says.
"I don't say nothing," I say.
"Are you certain he—" she whispers loud enough for me to hear.
"Pan is most reliable, aren't you, Pan?" Mr. Burton says. "I know how to be discreet," I say. Mr. Burton's eyebrows go up, and then he gives me a smile.
"Discreet, eh? We shall count on that, Pan," he says.
For months after, Mr. Burton is whistling like never before. And I know why, but I keep my mouth shut, even when I hear Robert and Molly talking almost every night at supper, both thinking that I don't know what's going on. Then, all of a sudden, everything stops. Mr. Burton stops teaching his art classes, and Miss Caroline don't come to the house no more. There's no more whistling, and Mr. Burton spends most of his time closed up in his study. One day, I go to Malcolm's room with an apple that Molly gives me from the cold storage room. "Hey, Malcolm," I say, "look what I got for you." And when I toss the apple in the air and go to catch it, I bump into Mr. Burton, who is sitting quiet in a chair and looking down at his feet. Malcolm flies over to me, and I make him talk before he gets the apple. But this is the first time the birds yapping don't get Mr. Burton to smile. I study the man for a while, then I say what he always says to me when I got trouble. "Mr. Burton," I say, "is there anything that you got on your mind?" I know he's going on a trip down into North Carolina to paint some birds, and I'm wondering if it would make him feel better if I was to go along and help him out. I'm about to say so when he looks up at me.
"How old are you now, Pan?" he asks.
"I'm 12," I say.
"You have always been wise beyond your years," he says.
Mr. Burton is the kind of man who needs to think before he talks, so I stay quiet and wait on him.
"I was 13 when I first met your father," he says. "Has Henry ever told you about our first meeting? They saved my life, you know."
My eyes open wide. In all these years, he's never talked to me about this. And my daddy won't say nothing about it either, even when I ask. "How did he do that?" I say. Mr. Burton puts his hands through his hair, making it go curly, not like mine, where it stands straight out if Robert don't keep it cut. "I'll tell you about my early years another time. For now, I have too many things to sort out. Seems I've made a mess of things."
Did you make a mess with Miss Caroline? I ask. He nods.
I'm afraid so, he says.
I try hard to think of something to say. My mama always said, as long as you tell the truth, you got that to stand on. Mr. Burton gives me a quick glance, then looks out the window.
Well, you certainly hit on the problem.
I can see he's done talking, so I go back and finish cleaning up after Malcolm. Then I hear Molly calling and I set out to find her. For a couple of weeks, I keep waiting for Mr. Burton to perk up, because I don't like to see him so quiet. He was never like this before. I keep trying to think of what to do, until one morning I remember how, before Miss Caroline was coming around, he was always talking to me about getting a parrot with green feathers. Where are you going to find one like that? I asked.
They bring them in on the ships, he said.
I've never been down to the docks. Robert and my daddy said for me to stay away because of slave catchers down there, but I'm old enough now to watch out for myself. Besides, my daddy's been talking all these years about getting caught by slave catchers, and nothing's happened to him. I got the money that Mr. Burton gives me, but I don't know how much a new bird is. I'm hoping I got enough with what Molly gives me.
Chapter 7 1830 James I left the evening celebration before supper was served. If I had stayed longer with Caroline, we would have given ourselves away. As it was, eyebrows were raised when she forgot herself and clung to my arm with both hands. When Mrs. Carden was called away, I quickly walked us toward the supper room, hoping for a lesser audience there. However, here too, in this great blue room, there was a flurry of activity as waiters and chefs rushed about. Under different circumstances, I might have appreciated the abundant displays of red roses and tall strawberry topiaries massed together on the mantels, tables, and sideboards. A confused waiter stood with a large covered dish in hand while two of the chefs squabbled. The sauce goes in front of the salmon. Never! It must be presented from a side table, the other argued. I led us to a corner and a large group of potted shrubs, tall as myself. Inadvertently, I stepped into the path of one of the servants, and we collided so firmly that the casserole dish he was carrying went flying. As the gold-rimmed china fell, splashing lobster Newberg across the carpet, Caroline reached for my hand and pulled me into a long, dark corridor. No sooner were we alone than she was in my arms. I felt weak from wanting her, but I held her back. Not here, not here. Why, James? She begged. Why haven't you seen me? Is it because of the child? No, Caroline, I said, no. But why, James? She asked. Why haven't you sent for me? I disturb you, is that it? The sight of me with child disturbs you? No, dearest, no. Her blue eyes shone with tears. Then tell me, why have you abandoned me? I pulled her close and spoke into her ear. I have not abandoned you, I whispered. I have been a coward, but I promise that I have not abandoned you. A servant startled us unexpectedly, and though he cast his eyes down as he hurried by, I was reminded again of the danger. I tried to put distance between us, but she would not release me. I must see you. When can we meet? Father is furious that I came here tonight, but I had to see you. I had to see you. Mother is insisting I go to the country. She said there are rumors and that I must go. Your mother is right. It will be safer for you out there. But she has invited me out to Stonehill, and I will come, I said. You will? Truly, you will? Give me your word, James, she pleaded, clinging to my arms while dropping her forehead onto my chest. My hand covered the nape of her soft neck. You have my word. I give you my word. As soon as the invitation arrives, I will come, I promised. How terrible I felt at her obvious distress. What had I done to this poor girl? Why had I not given her more support? Another waiter averted his eyes as he passed by. Come now, before we are discovered, I said and drew her hand to my arm. Just in time, for no sooner did we appear in the doorway than a male cousin sent by Mr. Carden swooped in and, with a haughty nod, swept Caroline away. She turned back and looked at me with such appeal that I took a step forward, then stopped myself. If I went for her, I didn't doubt she would come with me, but what then? I had no plan in place. I stood back beside the potted shrubs, oblivious to the scurrying waiters. Why had I kept us apart for so long? If only I had told her the truth about myself from the beginning. But I loved her as I had never loved before. And always there was the fear of her rejection. Yet in not seeing her, I had missed her need for me. To learn that she saw my absence as abandonment filled me with shame. And to think that there was the chance that our child could have color. How could I not have told her? Not only would she be horrified, she would be unprepared for potential danger. There were many stories of such situations that ended with rumors of murdered babies and mothers mysteriously disappearing. There was no way around it. The time had come. I must prepare her. I would go to Stonehill, as promised, and there confess everything. I would plead her forgiveness and promise to provide the child a home, if that were necessary. Nothing would be more difficult than to lay this at her feet, yet tonight I had seen the suffering that my deceit had caused her. A party of older women who had come early to assess the banquet were now staring at me. When I noted their attention with a nod, their fans flew open and they began to whisper. I needed no further encouragement to quietly depart.
Chapter 8. March 1830. Pan.
Friday morning, I slip out and head on down to the docks. I'm scared to go because if my daddy finds out, I don't know what he'd do. The last time I talked to my daddy about going down to the ships, him and me was sitting downstream by his creek, catching us some fish. Nobody fries fish up like my daddy, and I tell him so. It's a good day when he can sit quiet. Some days he's too jumpy and can't stop looking over his shoulder for his old master.
"You're growing up, son,"
he says after I see him take a quick look at me. "But you never gonna be a strong one. It good you learning to work a big house for the white folk." "You think I'm big enough now to go see those ships?" I ask, and Daddy gives me a look that means business.
"When I tells you to stay away from down there, I means that you stay away," he says.
"Then how about you take me there?" I ask.
"Boy, you never gonna find me going close to that place. There's some slave catchers that come up from the Carolinas and Georgia that get a hold of you, tie you up on a boat, and take you back down, sell you for a slave. Nope, you and me got no business never going down there," he says.
"If they take us, we just tell them we're free, Daddy."
"Once they got you, talk don't do you no good."
"I'm not afraid of them," I say. "They ever get a hold of me, I can write to Mr. Burton, tell him to come get me." I don't see his hand coming, and it catches me on the back of my head. He clips me so hard, everything spins. I grab hold of my head, and I can't talk, 'cause I'm trying not to cry. He never hit me like that before, and I stand up, 'cause it's no fun fishing no more. "Why did you hit me?" I ask, rubbing at my head. "Mama always said nobody should hit nobody else." He gets up too, but he looks so mad that he's scaring me, and I take some steps back.
"There's plenty more where that came from if I ever find out you go down there," he says.
I got nothing to say, so I sit down again and go to pick up my fishing pole. But I'm glad Robert makes me carry a handkerchief, because I got to blow my nose when I'm crying. Daddy walks around for a while, then comes and sits down, and I see his hands are shaking when he picks up his pole. When I look up, I see his chin wobbling like maybe he's gonna cry. I don't know what else to do, so I reach over and pat at his arm. "I don't mean no harm, Daddy. I always do like you say."
"Long as you don't go down there," he says. "You don't never want to get took for a slave."
"What was it like being a slave? Why won't you never tell me about it?" I ask. He looks over the water. Then all at once he sets his pole down and turns so I can see when he holds up both his hands to wiggle what's left of his thumbs. "This what they do to a slave," he said. "They cut you up in little pieces." Looking at his thumbs like that gives me chicken skin. "Why didn't you get out of there sooner?"
"'Cause I had a mama and a little brother."
"What happened to your mama?" I ask.
"You don't want to know," he says. "You don't want to know."
With his hand, he start pounding on his leg. "You gonna hurt yourself like that," I say, reaching for his hand to stop him. "Don't do that."
He looks down where I'm holding his hand and then looks right into my face, something he never likes to do. His eyes look so scared that I'm glad when his pole starts jumping, because I don't want him talking about being a slave no more. "Let's just catch some fish, Daddy," I say, and we do. The sun is bright when I start out early in the day. Most of the snow is melted, and I don't wear my big coat because I don't think I'll be needing it. I won't be gone that long. I'm going down to the boats just once to get Mr. Burton his bird, and I'm hoping my daddy don't find out nothing about it. Mr. Burton got a map of the city on his library wall, and I study it good before I set out. I know how to get down to Market Street, and from there I head toward the docks. I keep walking until finally, before I even get there, I hear the seagulls screeching, and my nose is filled with the smell of fish and water. When I go past the man selling fish, my heart starts pounding because I know I should turn around, but I tell myself not to be a baby. I start to think I should have worn my warm coat because it's cold down by the water, but I keep walking when I see in front of me a boat tied up that is so big it's got to be 10 times the size of Mr. Burton's house. On both sides of me is docks pointing out like fingers, and off them docks are boats lined up, one bigger than the next. At first I got to hold my ears for the noise. There's wagons and carts and men pitching stacks of boxes and barrels, and the workers are yelling to each other, one louder than the other. And the same thing is happening up and down the river as far as I can see. Out on the water there is already some ships moving out, with their sails puffed like big bellies full of wind. I forget about being scared because there's so much to see, and I move on in. "Hey, you, get out of the way," I hear, and I almost get myself clipped when a wagon pulls up loaded with barrels. The driver stops his horses and hops down while men come over to unload his wagon. When they start working, he looks over at me. "What you looking for, boy?" he asks, none too friendly. There's a sweet smell that I can't place. "What's in those?" I ask. "Best brandy you ever gonna taste," he says. "Boys," he tells his helpers, "I think we got someone here wanting to buy a barrel of brandy." Some of them laugh like they know something I don't. The driver looks at me. "Hey, you got no business down here. You best get on home." "But I come down here to buy a parrot," I say. "You what?" he asks. "I want to get a bird," I say. "Do you know where they sell birds?" "Boys," he calls out, "any of you know where to find a bird?" One of the men laughs and points toward the seagulls that shriek and swoop down around our heads. "Take as many as you want," he yells, and this time they all laugh, but one of the men stops before he picks up a barrel. "You looking for those parrot types? Sometimes they bring 'em in down the line," he points forward. "Down a ways there's a tavern called Dockside. Go on in there. They'll tell you where they bring 'em in." The driver jumps back up on his wagon. "Go on now. Get out of here before you get run over," he says, and I have to jump out of his way when he swings his horses around. Even though I got to walk a long time, I find the tavern easy enough, and I'm standing outside wondering what to do when two men come pushing out the door. The bigger one almost falls over me. "Hey, boy, out of my way." His face is burned red, and his yellow mustache, curled on each side like half a moon, moves when he talks. "Sorry," I say, moving back. "You dress fine for a nigger boy," he says. "What you doing down here?" "I want to buy a parrot," I say, "one that talks." "You looking for a parrot, you say?" He looks around. "Where's your daddy?" He pulls a knife out from his belt and starts to cut a fingernail. "He works out of town," I say, wondering why he wants to know about my daddy. "And your mama?" he asks. "She down here with you?" "My mama pass on," I say. But after that, something doesn't sit right the way the two men look at each other. I take a few steps back, thinking it's time to leave. "Hey, where you going?" the man with the knife asks. "I got to go home," I say. "Didn't you say you was looking for a bird?" I nod. "A green parrot." "Well," says the man as he slips the knife back into his belt, "if that don't beat all, turns out we got one." The two men nod at each other, and I get a funny feeling up the back of my neck. I start walking away, but they both walk up beside me, one on each side. "Say, boy, don't you want to do business with us?" The one with the knife grabs hold of my shoulder.
Name's Skinner. What's yours?
Pan, I say, but now all I want is to go home.
Well, Pan, we got a bird for you.
I think I gotta go home, I say.
I think first you should come with us to see the birds, Skinner says,
and his hand grips tight on me.
How much money you got to buy our bird?
I tell him that I only got a few coins saved up.
That'll do, he says.
I don't like his hand on me and try to pull away, but he just holds tighter to my shoulder and pushes me along. I'm scared and I want to leave, but I'm in between the two of them and I don't know what to do.
How far up are we going?
I ask. And when they don't say nothing, I think maybe they don't hear me.
We're moving fast, and I keep telling myself to set out at a run, but Skinner's hand is gripped on tight. I think maybe I should call out, but when a ship pulls out of the dock, there's so much creaking and groaning from the boat, and so much yelling from the men working, that there's too much noise for anybody to hear me. We get to one of the piers where there's a smaller boat tied up, and I want to say something to the colored man that's sitting there smoking his pipe, but when he sees me, he looks away, out onto the water. Skinner goes ahead and walks up a strung-up board that takes him across the water and onto the boat.
Come on, he says, waving to me.
The other man gets up behind me while I look around.
Where are the birds? I ask him.
We got 'em on board, he says, then spits into the water, which looks almost black.
I got to go on the boat to see them? I ask.
Yep, he said. We keep 'em below. Otherwise, they're talking too much.
I start to tell him that I don't want to go on the boat, but he gives me a push and says, get on up there before I dump you in the river.
He sounds like he means it, so I move quick.
The board stretched out over the water is wiggly, and I got to hold on tight to the rope to get across. As soon as I get close, Skinner reaches for my hand and yanks me in. I yell out and try to pull away, but the rag he puts across my mouth has a strong smell, and then I don't remember what happens next.
When I wake up, the boat is moving back and forth, back and forth, and all I can think of is that I got to get up on my feet and get out of there. When I try to stand, my feet slide out from under me, and I land next to something that's making a noise. I'm so scared that my legs don't want to hold me up, so I just stay sitting until my eyes get used to the dark, and I see a small colored boy laying next to me. There's a bad stink, and when I look over to see where the smell is coming from, the boy gets sick all over himself, and some of it lands on me.
Stop it, I say, and push away. My head hurts and my stomach don't feel good, but I stay sitting up to try to figure out what's happening. It's like the floor is moving under me, and so I'm guessing that we're out on the water, but where are we going?
What are you doing here? I ask the boy.
They took me, he says, then starts crying. I wants my mama. I wants my mama.
He sounds like a baby, and the more he calls for his mama, the louder he gets.
Stop crying, I say. You're hurting my head yelling like that.
I wants my mama, he says, but then he gets quiet and vomits again.
Hearing him do that, I can't hold back no more and do the same, and we both keep at it until nothing's left in my stomach or in his. My head hurts so bad that I lay back and fall asleep. I wake up to see him watching me. My head is still sore, but my stomach is quiet even though the boat is rocking. I sit up quick to look around.
Where are we? I ask. Where are we going?
I don't know, he says.
What's your name? I ask.
I's Randall.
He looks so small.
How old are you? I ask.
I's 5, he says, and when he looks at me, I wonder if I was that little when I was taking care of my mama.
My name's Pan.
How old is you?
I'm 12 years old.
You big as my brother, he says.
His voice starts to shake.
He was fighting them, and they hit him on the head, and I don't know where he got to.
I don't have no brother, I say, talking fast so his crying don't start up again. But I got a bird.
A bird? He asks.
But I don't answer when I start thinking of how a bird got me here.
I got all kinds of questions, and when I think of them, each one scares me more.
Who is that Skinner? Where is he taking me? Is he a slave catcher, like my daddy said? Is he gonna sell me? Will I be a slave? Will they cut me up like they did my daddy?
What's going to happen to us?
Randall asks.
I don't know, I say. When he scuttles over close to me and starts to cry, stinking off, I start to cry myself. That stops him and he looks up at me.
Is you crying? Is you scared too?
Then I remember my mama's friend Sheila and how she takes care of me when I'm as small as him. I'm too big to cry, I say, and I put my arm around him. You just hold on till I can think of how to get us out of here. We was just laying there when Skinner comes down and slips in our sick and starts yelling so loud that Randall starts to shake all over. What kind of mess did the two of you make?
We got sick is all, I say.
Well, you're going to clean it up.
Where are you taking us? I ask. Where are we going?
Never mind, he says. I'm going to bring you water and I want this mess cleaned up.
It don't take long before he comes back with a bucket and a rag. After he leaves, I wash the two of us down as best I can, then I clean up the floor. The only light we got is from the trap door on top of our heads that got a ladder, and that's where Skinner comes down to bring us our food. Randall don't want the hard bread and cheese, but I know we got to get something in our stomach, so I tell him, I'll take a bite, then you take a bite. And that's the way I get him to eat a little. The next time I see Skinner, I ask him again where we're going.
None of your business, he says.
But I want to go back home. Before I know it, I start yelling at him. Where are we going? You got to tell us where you're taking us.
He walks over and stands right in front of me and talks real quiet.
I guess you don't hear me the first time. I said it's none of your business.
I don't care no more. I got to know. I stop yelling and straighten myself up and try to sound like Robert. I believe that it is my business, I say. You brought me here to see...
His fist winds up and catches me, and I go down.
Get off of me, Skinner yells, and I see Randall, who's been hanging on to Skinner's arm, go flying against the wall where he plops down with a yelp like a puppy.
After Skinner goes, I try to sit up, but I can't, and Randall crawls over. When I moan, he whispers, Is you hurt? Is you hurt bad?
While I lay there, Randall sits close beside me, waiting, his hands squeezed together tight in his lap, and I still can't believe that he tried to fight off Skinner.
I wish I was brave as you, I say. I want my mama, he says, and even though he don't make no sound of crying, water is coming from his eyes.
Tell you what, I say. Soon as we get to land, I'll write to Mr. Burton. He'll come for us.
You can get us out of here?
Yep, I say. I'll send a letter to Mr. Burton, and he'll come.
Randall grabs at my hand.
And you take me with you?
Course I'll take you with me, I say. I'm not going no place without you.
After that, I find what looks like an old sail and wrap us both in it, 'cause we's cold. Even when he's sleeping, Randall keeps a hold of my hand. The only time we see Skinner is when he brings us food and empties our slop pail, but I don't ask him no more questions. It's hard to tell how many days go by, 'cause after a while, one day is like the next. I keep telling Randall not to worry, that as soon as I write to Mr. Burton, he'll come for us, and probably in his big carriage, too. When Randall's cold, I tell him about the fur rugs that Mr. Burton keeps in his carriage, and how we will use them to get warm on the ride home. He likes to have me talk, so I tell him about the house I live in, and how it's my home, and how good Mr. Burton is to me. I tell him about all the food I get to eat, how I take care of Malcolm, and how Mr. Burton says that when I'm ready, he's going to send me to a school in New York. I don't tell him about my daddy being a slave, and how every day we're on the water, I keep thinking of how Mr. Burton just got to come find us, because if Skinner's a slave catcher, I don't want to be no slave. I think of what they did to my daddy's hands, and my fingers hurt just thinking about it. And when I feel Randall's hand in mine, I know for sure they can't cut nothing off of Randall, because he's way too little to lose no fingers. By the time the boat ties up, we both got a bad cough, and even though I try to get Randall to eat, he's too sick.
The two of you shut up or you get my boot, Skinner warns when he brings us up out of the hold.
It's warmer here, and someone at the dock says we're in Virginia. Right away I feel better, because I remember from a map Mr. Burton showed me that Virginia is right close to North Carolina, and that's where he's coming to paint his birds, and I'll bet he can find us easy. The sharp sun hurts my eyes, but I make them stay open so I can see where we are when they load us on a wagon. There aren't as many docks as Philadelphia, but it seems like the same kind of men are yelling and fussing, and there's bunches of them working the boats. But none of them look at me and Randall, and I can't call out anyway because Skinner's hand is squeezing tight at the back of my neck. He throws us up on the wagon, and when the wagon moves, he starts cussing at the driver because he only got one horse and it don't move too good. When the driver starts cussing back, Randall takes my hand. It's a while before we're away from the docks, because we got to work our way past all the other horses and wagons coming and going. Most are piled so high with the stacks of wood and barrels that you can't see over them. We finally get on a road, and after we travel out some, we take a turn that cuts through the trees, which is already greening up. But I don't look around much because we're bumping along so hard that I got to work on keeping Randall and me in the wagon. Skinner is cussing all the way until we get to a couple of small barns. When the wagon stops, Skinner pulls us down, but it's hard to stand after the boat. The driver comes round to look at us.
"This the best you can do? Together they ain't worth nothing. One's too little and the other's too scrawny. The bigger one's got educating, so he'll bring something," Skinner says. "That's not where the money is. They want him for the fields. You know they're watching those docks in Philly real close now. Those niggas up there getting a little too set up organizing with them Quakers. We had a better one, strong built, but he went down too hard. Fish food now. You must have roughed him up too much again. I told you they's like handling money. When you gonna learn?" I hold tight to Randall's hand and hope he don't understand what they say about his brother. Just when I'm thinking of making a run for it, Skinner grabs us both by the neck and pushes us into a room at the back of a small barn. They lock us in, and when the wagon thumps away, the two of them are still cussing at each other.
"Now can you write to your man?" Randall asks when he sits down beside me on the dirt floor.
"I don't have no paper," I say.
"But you got to write to him to get us out of here," he says, his voice so high and the next thing to crying.
"Shh," I say, looking back over my shoulder. "Somebody might be listening."
He looks round and moves closer to me, but after a coughing fit, he quiets down. Then, as though he's got nothing left in him, he lays down and puts his head in my lap.
"My head's hurting," he says, "and I's cold."
"You sleep some while I figure this out," I say, and I rub across his bony little shoulders and wonder why he says he's cold when he feels so hot. I wait till he's sleeping before I move, careful not to wake him. Then I go over to the window and try jumping up, but it's too high, and besides, it's got some boards across it. I try the door, but it's locked tight, like I figured. I kick at it some until I hurt my foot, and when I limp around, I start crying. Finally, I go back and sit next to Randall, because he's coughing so bad and shaking in his sleep. That night, Skinner shows up with the driver and another man. I jump up as soon as they come in the door, and it don't take a minute before Randall is up beside me and got a hold of me.
"What they gonna do?" he asks me.
"Shh," I say, trying to see past the lantern that Skinner holds up.
"They's both scrawny," says the new one. "Give me 300, says Skinner, "and you can have 'em both. Thomas doesn't take 'em when they're that small. Too much trouble. I'll give you 100 for the older one. And give me 20 for the runt. You know you can sell 'em on the way down," Skinner says. "He'll bring you twice that."
"Deal," says the man.
And when he comes over with the rope, I step back and Randall moves with me. "If I give you my money, can he stay with me?" I ask.
"Let me see how much you got," the man says.
I unfold the rag that holds my coins, and with a swipe he pockets it.
"And now you don't have none," he says with a laugh.
"But that's stealing," I say, before I can stop myself. He laughs again.
"Sounds to me like you got some educating. You one of those mamby-pamby house boys? Won't take long for Thomas to work that out of you."
"Can Randall please stay with—" I start, and before I can duck, the man sends his fist at me.
"I don't want to hear nothing from you after this," he says.
When I spit out blood, a tooth comes too, and Randall starts screaming. But I don't shush him, 'cause I'm crying too hard myself.
Part 2 Chapter 9 1830 James On my return from the event, Robert had the outdoor lamps burning when my carriage drew up to the house, and as usual, he was waiting for me at the front door. "There is a fire in the library," he said as he took my greatcoat and hat. "Any news of Pan?" I asked. "No, I'm afraid not," he said, and without further comment, I went to the library, craving the solitude. "Something hot to drink?" he called after me. "Go to bed, Robert," I said, closing the door behind me. It was past midnight. I went to the familiar chair next to the fire and sank into its worn leather, sighing deeply. This room always gave me comfort. How grateful I was to Robert for anticipating my need for a fire this evening. How I relied on him. I thought of him now brushing down my coat and hat and then finishing up his chores for the night. Lamps and candlesticks would be collected and carried down to the kitchen where Molly would clean them in the morning. Then, if he hadn't already, Robert would go for a final assessment of the small parlor where I took my morning meal. There, he would make sure that the grate had been cleaned and the logs set for an early morning fire. He would check to see that the tea table was covered with a linen cloth, the crease set exactly down the center, and in the morning my tray would hold a crystal salt cellar, a porcelain egg cup with a soft-cooked egg, a slice of ham, and next to it a small cruet of mustard. There would be butter set on ice in the gleaming silver butter dish, and after I spread it on my warm toast, I would clip off the top of the egg and dip the buttered toast into the warm yellow yolk. Then, while I enjoyed my tea in the morning paper, Pan would likely show up to ask some precocious question that would undoubtedly amuse me. Pan. How accustomed I was to having him here. Robert was my mainstay, the one who established and adhered to a routine that gave me balance. But Pan. Pan was the one who gave me cheer. And where was he now? I reassured myself that he was resilient enough to look out for himself until he was rescued. After all, he was already 12. Close to the age that I was when Henry found me. I rested my head back and closed my eyes, reviewing my own capabilities at that young age, but all I could recall was how helpless and utterly terrified I had been on my arrival in Philadelphia. It took me weeks to begin to trust Henry. All of my life, Grandmother had instilled in me that Negroes were sly and dangerous and not to be trusted. Now, though, I was not only eating and sleeping next to Henry, I was also relying on him to see to my needs. His feral way of life was foreign to me, yet he taught me daily survival skills, and by the time my health was fully restored, I was beginning to enjoy the outdoor independent life. Under my grandmother's roof, I'd had servants to do my bidding, and my most difficult challenge had been to voice a request. Here with Henry, I was expected to do my share of the work and was soon responsible for gathering the wood and tending the fire. Rather than viewing this as a hardship, I found it stimulating and woke each morning with renewed vigor. In the early fall, Henry began to bring up the subject of my going into the city to find employment. But I avoided the issue, for the idea of leaving him petrified me. This man had not only saved my life, but continued to provide for me. And daily I grew more dependent on him. Then one evening, after we had just finished a satisfying meal of wild onion and rabbit stew, Henry approached the subject again. We sat near the crackling fire, but the night around us had turned cold. "The snow coming," he said, "and I got to move out."
"Where to?"
"I got another place away from here, place tighter for the winter." I didn't look at him, but shifted closer to the fire. "Can I come with you?" I asked.
"I could pay you if you let me stay."
"And with what you gon' do that?" he asked. I hesitated but decided I had no choice except to trust him.
"I have some jewelry," I said. "I can sell it."
I glanced over to read his response.
"I don't suppose you keepin' it in that coat of yours," he said with a half smile.
I nodded and quickly slipped off my jacket. Using my whittling knife, I carefully slit open one of the hidden pockets that sheltered a piece of jewelry. From inside, I pulled out my grandmother's ring, set with a large blue sapphire and surrounded by sizable diamonds. My stomach clenched at the memory of her hand, only months before smoothing my hair. Was it possible she was dead? I forced myself away from the dark thought and held up the ring for Henry to see.
"We can sell this," I said.
"Boy,"
You got to use that to find yourself a place to live. It's time you move on. You stay out here, they're gonna peg you for a nigger, he said. No sense in that. But where will I go? My voice rose high. You got to get yourself into the city. Look around. Not gonna find no work sitting out here. There's lots of streets full of places where white people got business. We get over there and you go on in, tell them you looking to work. Any kind of work you good at? I'm good at reading and writing, and I can do numbers. And I know how to draw and paint. Grandmother had two of my paintings framed. Sparks flew when Henry rearranged a log. I rubbed hard at my temples, trying to stop the thoughts from pushing through. But they were burned up. Everything was burned up. My voice trembled as I shook my head, trying to dislodge the memory of the great flames that had taken our home. I whimpered, remembering how I had scanned the smoldering rubble for remains of grandmother, a woman I had always thought of as my mother. Boy, Henry said, you got to let go of those things and keep moving on or they take you down. But I keep thinking of the fire, of the pain she was in. I tried not to cry. She don't feel nothing now. She's gone. It's you that feeling something. You think that's what she's wanting for you? Feeling the hurt that she's not feeling no more? My throat was too choked to answer. I've been through enough to know you can't carry nobody's hurt. Hard enough to carry your own. I nodded. Now we got to get back to figuring out work for you. Is there any kind of work you can do with all that learning and books? Well, I can paint and sketch pretty good, Henry grunted. I don't know nothing about that. Best we just get you in there. It not gonna be hard for a boy that look white as you to find hisself some work. The next evening, Henry came home with news of a pawn shop where I could go to sell my piece of jewelry. How about we go in the morning? He said as easily as that. I was so scared and angry with Henry for pressuring me to leave that I couldn't sleep that night. What if Rankin and the patrollers were still looking for me? Until now, out in the woods and under Henry's protection, I hadn't worried about anyone finding me, but what if they came looking for me in the city? As dawn broke, Henry had me roll my few belongings inside a burlap feed bag. We were deep in a forest, and as Henry led us out through the towering oaks and pines, I started to mark a trail, bending back twigs as he had taught me to do in case I needed to find my way back. But Henry moved so quickly that I soon had to turn my attention to keeping up. We traveled for a good while before we arrived at the outskirts of the forest, where lay a well-traveled road that led into the city. There we set out on what would have been a long walk of some miles had a farmer, driving a one-horse cart, not stopped. "You wanting a ride?" he asked. Henry nodded to me and I answered, "Yes, we would." The driver waved me up to my rightful place on the seat beside him, while Henry found room for himself in the back of the cart. The driver slapped the reins and the horse moved out. Once underway, he glanced over at me. "You and your man going into town?" he asked.
"Yes."
"You from these parts?"
"No, I'm from Virginia,"
I answered nervously until I remembered Henry's coaching. If they start asking too many questions, you start asking some of your own.
"Are you from here?"
I asked.
"I mean, is this where you were born?"
"Yes, sir. Born and raised, but my parents come from Germany. They're gone now, but they left me a small farm. Me and the boys, I got two of them, we raise some cattle and crops like these potatoes." He nodded back toward his cargo. "We make out all right, bringing carrots and potatoes into the market whenever we got some." The man pulled his battered hat low over his head to shade his weathered face, and he gripped the brown leather reins as he guided his horse over the rut-filled road. "That rain last week didn't help this road," he said. "Lucky it's dry today, though. That mud can be rough to get through."
I bobbed my head in agreement, though I had no experience with driving or difficult road conditions. Until my recent flight from Tall Oaks, I had been so sheltered by grandmother that in all of my 13 years, I had never left our farm.
"First time in the city?" he asked. I nodded again. Seeing that I had little to lend to a conversation, the man began to whistle, leaving me free to look about. The wagon bounced down the rutted road that cut through a dense forest, and I was soon sorry for having no gloves, fearing splinters as I gripped tight to the side of the wooden cart. We passed by a number of small farms where the fields had been cleared and chickens wandered about the gardens and apple orchards. The farmhouses were solidly built of stone or brick,
and though most were not of large size, they looked sturdy. However, my interest soon shifted as we